This is VSiN by the Books on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Hour number three, it is VSiN by the Books. I'm Dave Ross here downtown Las Vegas at Circa. He's our closer, Jensen Lewis, on the road again in Chapel Hill, getting ready for the Super Regionals later on this weekend. Always a pleasure to talk about the ponies. We got some great, really sharp people here at the network. One of them kind enough to join us now, Aaron Halterman. Give him a follow on X at @racing_dudes. Joins us here in the Progressive Guest Line. Aaron, great to have you here on a Thursday before we get to Saturday at the Belmont in Saratoga. For the novice horse fans out there, or bettors out there, when you don't have the prospects of a Triple Crown, which we do not have this year, do you feel like it's a better opportunity because all the eyeballs are on that one horse whenever you're trying to make horse racing history? Can you kind of now, with maybe lesser eyeballs on there, find some more profitable angles?
I absolutely think you can, yeah. And look, there's nothing better than being at Belmont Park, or Saratoga in this case, coming up this weekend for the Belmont when the Triple Crown is on the line. I mean, the feeling is just unmatched. It's incredible. But, you know, you're right. When you look at this field and when you kind of look at a non-Triple Crown Belmont, you got a wide open field a lot of times. And that's kind of what we've got here. There's a couple that you really can't make a case for, but there's eight horses. There's five of them I could really say, hey, they've got a shot. We could kind of make a case. And the other part of it for this year is I feel like even though we don't have a Triple Crown on the line, it's extremely exciting because we do have the Preakness winner versus the Kentucky Derby winner. And that brings a lot of intrigue to the race.
And Aaron, also, and before we get your specific breakdown of specific horses that you do like, this is always a big thing for us when we talk baseball. Of course, the weather, you know, being able to factor in, it looks like that could be a bit iffy on Saturday. How much in these Triple Crown races does that affect your handicap and knowing what those conditions could look like at post time?
Yeah, it absolutely is going to play a part of this thing. There's no doubt about it. You know, Saratoga is where they're going to have the Belmont this year. We are forecasted for rain Friday evening and into Saturday morning and maybe even pushing to the afternoon. So I do think we may have a prospect of a sloppy track again. You know, I think the big advantage, if the track does come up sloppy, we just saw it 5 weeks ago in the Kentucky Derby. You know, if you guys watched that race, it was extremely sloppy that day. So we do kind of know, look, Sovereignty looked very good over a sloppy track, ran the race of his life over it. So we kind of know, hey, we're going to elevate him if we do have a wet track. But Journalism and Baeza, the second and third place finishers who are also in this race, they ran pretty well over it as well. So a lot of times it is a big unknown. So that is kind of the one good thing. If it does rain, if it is kind of sloppy, we saw him in Kentucky do it. We saw him run over a track that was pretty sloppy there. So at least we kind of have a feel for, hey, the three horses that are really, really good that we think the most of, we saw him perform pretty well over a rainy racetrack. So hopefully it doesn't. You always want a fast track on the big days, but hey, it's Saratoga. It could rain any day up there. The weather is pretty volatile.
It absolutely can be. And I used to spend a lot of my youth up there at Saratoga Springs in that area. And Aaron, this is the second year now that it's going to be held at Saratoga with those renovations going on at Belmont Park. Can you take anything away from the style of race, why it might be different from Belmont into year number two now being at Saratoga?
Yeah, for sure. I think the biggest thing, well, there's two things. The one obvious thing is the race is at a mile and a quarter at Saratoga instead of a mile and a half. They kind of did some research. There was just no way they could make it work and run it at a mile and a half. So they shortened it up to a mile and a quarter. So that is the huge difference. That's the main thing that's always going to stick out with it being at Saratoga. The other thing, and kind of the thing that really played into the race last year, Saratoga's main track, meaning their dirt track, usually favors horses that are on the front. So horses, they maybe don't have to be on the lead early, but they need to be in that first flight of horses, first, second, or third. And so if it plays like that again this year, which it definitely did last year, where the horses that were 1-2 at the beginning of the race were 1-2 at the finish of the race, if that happens again, you really have to kind of adjust. So kind of watch throughout the day. Of course, there's 14 races on the card, so you'll get a good idea before the Belmont runs. But we'll see if speed kind of holds like it did last year. And that could really hurt a horse like Sovereignty, who won the Kentucky Derby, from coming way out of it. So that is something we got to take into account. Saratoga, especially going longer, the horses that are in front usually stay in front.
Aaron, let's dive into it then. Give us some of your top picks, horses you like, and specifics why people should back those horses.
Yeah, so the horse I like on top is the number 7, Journalism. And if you guys haven't watched the Preakness Stakes, go back and watch it. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. The horse gets stopped, and Samich and I are live on the air, and we're like, oh, this is a disaster. You know, we're getting ready to just roast jockey Umberto Rispoli. And then Journalism re-rallies and wins the race in incredible fashion. So number 7, Journalism on top for me. I picked him to win the Kentucky Derby. Unfortunately, he gets second. I did pick him to win the Preakness, so he wins there. So I'll pick him again in the Belmont. You know, all three races, I am going to pick him. I think he's the most consistent horse. I think, you know, overall, he is the most talented horse. He's pretty tactical, and what I mean by that, if the racetrack is playing to speed, he can sit two or three lengths off of it and still be okay. And then if it's going really fast and is favoring closers, he can sit a little bit farther back and be okay as well. So I like number 7, Journalism on top. I do like number 6, Baeza, in second. I think he's very interesting. So he's a horse that is developing late. He got going kind of late into the season. He didn't win his first race until February. He didn't run in his first stakes race until April, where he only lost by 3/4 of a length to Journalism. Came back in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, 19 horses. This horse was kind of in another world based on what he had been facing before till now. He didn't get the best of trips. He still re-rallied. He almost got second. He just missed second by just a bit. So he's getting better. Out of the 8 horses in the race, he's the one that I could see improving the most here. And if we do see that improvement, I think he's right there where not only can he hit the board, he can win. So the 7, Journalism, the 6, Baeza, that's the 2 horses I like. I do have Sovereignty, the number 2 horse in third. My worry with him in this race, when you look back at the Kentucky Derby, the pace was so fast, and that really helps horses that are coming from the back. I don't see that fast of a pace setting up here for the Belmont, and that has me a little bit worried about Sovereignty. Now, again, though, how we were talking earlier, if the track comes up sloppy, that does elevate him for me. But if it's just a fast track, I like the 7 and I like the 6.
You know, Aaron, it's interesting because we're talking about the Stanley Cup rematch that we're having with Florida and Edmonton right now, whether or not that's good for the sport or you want some new blood in there. With Sovereignty and Journalism going head-to-head here, and I know that's the way it's being built, even though you like Baeza to get that second spot here. Is this good? Does this generate some of that conversation and or revenue in the betting space that we do want to see Sovereignty and Journalism and figure out who is the best horse here in 2025?
I absolutely think it's great. We need rivalries in racing. We honestly, for horse racing, just to put it bluntly, we need a reason for the casual person to want to tune in to watch the races. I mean, I think that's the biggest problem with horse racing. The niche audience, they're all about it. Like me and like Mike Samich, like we're in it 24/7, right? But for other people, they kind of need a reason to get nudged, to get pushed into watching it. So when you think about Sovereignty versus Journalism, number one, you know, all the casuals watch the Kentucky Derby, right? So that's fresh in their mind. Man, Sovereignty, he was great. And usually the casual person, whether it's a bettor or a fan that's going to be a bettor on these big days, they love a closer because they're exciting. They're like 15th up the backstretch and they close in to win. And so people really like him. And then you've got Journalism, who ran well in the Derby and then did this incredible thing in the Preakness where he's kind of attracted new fans. And now we're getting that rematch. So I think in horse racing terms, this is really what we wanted. I feel like if we were missing one of these two horses in this race, it would not have the same kind of feeling. But since we've got them both, and even people that are in the horse racing space, you know, we're kind of talking amongst each other going, wow, yes, a Triple Crown would be more exciting. However, getting this rematch, it's kind of one of the more exciting Belmont Stakes that doesn't have a Triple Crown on the line that I can remember, at least in the last 10 or 15 years. So I think it's absolutely great they're both here, and hopefully it's a rivalry that just kind of keeps going throughout the summer.
Love it, Aaron. And speaking of rematches, let me pivot with you to the Stanley Cup Final from last night. We get the bookend with Leon Draisaitl getting the first of the night and the game winner in overtime. Edmonton out to the 1-0 series lead. 77% of teams, I think, that win game one end up hoisting the cup. What do you see in game two? Can the Panthers get the equalizer and send this thing back to Sunrise all level at one?
It was really an incredible game. And I know there was debate, is the rematch good or bad? When you watched that game last night, I'm going to say, I think it's really good because I think these guys are just the two best teams. I mean, they're so deep and talented. McDavid is incredible. So incredible game last night. Let's hope it goes 7 if the games are going to be like that, because it'll be fantastic. But to your question, I'm going to back Florida in game 2 to get this thing tied up. I like that they're the underdog. I think that's the right price, plus 105, 110. That's kind of where they're landing, and I think that's right. I think that's good enough. I think Florida is going to tie this thing up. I personally, when I see these two teams, I don't see a lot of difference. And when you watched game one, what you saw was in stretches, yep, Edmonton had the advantage, and then in stretches, Florida had the advantage. You look at the second period, if you just watched the second period, you thought, well, Florida's a lot better team, right?
Absolutely.
And then you watch the third period in the overtime, and you go, well, wait a second, I think Edmonton's the better team. That's what it's going to be all series, in my opinion, guys. So, yeah, to answer your question again, I am going to go Florida on the money line. I do think they're going to be able to tie this thing up. I do think it's going seven games.
So, again, going to go seven there. That is an interesting handicap. And, again, for the Belmont this week, Aaron, for those that are just listening here, you're going to go with journalism, and then you're going to come back with Baeza as a two-horse and then Sovereignty at the three?
Yep, you got it. And, like I said, hopefully we do get that showdown, Sovereignty journalism. If it comes in 1-2 that way, at least we're going to get kind of what we went to see.
Awesome. Aaron, really appreciate you hopping on here. I can't wait to watch the race on Saturday, and I'm sure you and Mike will be breaking it down as you always do. Enjoy that listen as well.
All right, thanks, guys.
There he is, Aaron Halterman. Give him a follow on X at @racing_dudes. And by the way, there is a challenge right now at our friends at First Bet. So it's the Belmont Stakes Pick'em Challenge. You can play for free. You're going to pick the winners of the weekend's top races. And I think Aaron just gave you some great insights as to where you might want to make those wagers. You're going to win great prizes from our friends over at First Bet. All you have to do is go to VSiN.com/Belmont for that Belmont Stakes Pick'em Challenge there at Saratoga. Okay, when we come back, the RBC Canadian Open is going on. How is Rory doing? We'll update next here. It's VSiN by the Books. By the Books on this Thursday edition. Great conversations with Aaron Halterman and Mike Palm in studio the last couple segments. And we're going to catch up with Reed Kuhn, talk all things UFC 316 before we say goodbye in this edition, Jensen. But right now, north of the border, Rory's basically in a sweater. It looks cold up there. I don't know how cold it is up there in Canada, close to Toronto, maybe 50 miles away. Not good with my geography either. But right now, he's not playing very well here, Jensen. Early on, I know. Remember, he was the far and away favorite to win this tournament before the week began. Right now, he's one over par, started off in the back nine here. So he only has one par five to play. That'll be the 18th hole here. So they're going to finish on a par five. Keep that in mind as the week goes. And remember, as the betting favorite here in the live odds, Rory is still the betting favorite, but if you wanted to hop on him now, he's plus 850. So he's drifted about $4 in the marketplace to begin this. Now, look, it's kind of a running joke, Jensen, with us, and I think our producer, Brandon Valesky, believes that I hate Rory. I don't. I love Rory, okay? I want this to be known. I am not trying to bash on one Rory McIlroy. He's great for the game and all of those things. But sometimes, Jensen, when you either protest too much or you don't protest at all, we got to ask questions. And the question was asked about Rory yesterday at his media avail here for the Canadian Open as to why he didn't speak to the media at all at the PGA Championship after he was just the cat's meow in the golf world after winning the career Grand Slam at Augusta in April, right? So you want to talk to Rory. Rory mentioned the real truth of the matter as to why he didn't speak to the media. And yes, it did have everything to do with the non-conforming driver. And I think we got it.
For me,
yep.
Yeah, I just was trying to gather my thoughts as far as like where I know I joked with you about like, okay, he would not be able to basically handle the scrutiny day in and day out of a big league clubhouse, get constantly asked questions about it. The equipment is one thing, but can you honestly put that aside or admit when you were wrong and then move on from
yeah.
it and be able to let your talent take over? Like that to me is where the next step should have been is, all right, this is not, if you are one of the best, if not the best player in the world, equipment shouldn't matter. and you should have just said, oh, you know what? Driver failed. That was my fault, and we're done with it. The idea that you and I were like, okay, well, did you use the driver in the Masters to win the Masters? You know, that question in and of itself was something like, didn't want to answer it. Now, I think it's just really snowballing on him, and everything is going to get magnified. He brought it on himself. He deserves it. All the scrutiny that comes with it as well.
And that will get us to whether or not this subject matter is news or noise.
Is it news?
Corleone is a man who insists on hearing bad news immediately.
Or just noise?
Are you going to act like this is news?
Just noise.
Let's separate the impactful from the insignificant with one simple question. News or noise?
You know, Jensen, it's why we do a segment, You Can't Handle the Truth. I can handle the truth. Just tell me the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Whether good, bad, or indifferent, then it's out there. And then, as you mentioned, and then we can all move on. So this was addressed yesterday about failing the driver that was non-conforming at the PGA Championship, which he did not play particularly well at. He wasn't the only one. And by the way, it was noted in real time. So here is Rory, and we'll decipher if this is news or noise on the failed driver at the PGA Championship.
Look, and also, like, the driver stuff, I was a little pissed off because I knew that Scotty's driver had failed on Monday, but my name was the one that was leaked. It was supposed to stay confidential. Two members of the media were the ones that leaked it. So why, you know, I didn't want to get up there and say something that I regretted either, you know, because there's a lot of people that I'm trying to protect. Scotty, I don't want to mention his name. I'm trying to protect TaylorMade. I'm trying to protect the USGA, PGA of America, myself. You know, so I just didn't want to get up there and say something that I regretted at the time. And with Scotty's stuff, like, that's not my information to share. I knew that that had happened, but, you know, that's not on me to share that. And I felt, you know, that process is supposed to be kept confidential, and it wasn't for whatever reason. And, you know, that's why I was pretty annoyed at that.
Oh boy, there's so much to unpack here in News or Noise. It gives a lot of Mike Gundy feels. Come at me, I'm a man, I'm 40. Remember, he was quote unquote protecting his quarterback way back in that historic rant. And now Rory's saying he was protecting Scotty, the tour, TaylorMade. I'm up here taking the what was that? Like, yes, Scotty's name came out in the report too. So if there's no there, and then a there comes out, why are you upset that the there comes out if there's no there? Like, I don't understand. If this is not supposed to be a story, why would you be mad if those people leaked the quote-unquote non-story? Why would that be an issue, Jensen?
Yeah, and again, that's why I go back to the ego part of it. Like, did you get your hand caught in the cookie jar when you shouldn't have, and now because it lines up with a timeline of when you win arguably the most prestigious tournament in golf, and it lingers. Like, if you want to let sleeping dogs lie, let it go. And I would have even circled the wagons a little bit. If I have other guys and my colleagues, and here's the dichotomy, Dave. All those golfers waited for Rory to celebrate with him after the Masters and yada, yada, yada. So you feel like he has the respect of a lot of his colleagues. Wouldn't you go back? Like, we used to do this in the outfield. Like, if I felt that maybe I was talking too loud in the clubhouse or I did something to upset the veterans, I'd kind of circle with my bullpen mates, both young and old, and be like, hey, I'm feeling this way.
Mm.
Do I need to address it? Do I need to come out? And, you know, or do I need to have a conversation? And I was lucky. I had great teammates who were like, you're kind of a little too much. Like, okay, all right, I'll handle it. I'm a man. You know, go handle it. And it's done. Then it's over with. And you get that added bit of respect from the rest of your team. It's like, hey, he admitted when he was wrong. He recognized it. You know, he atoned for it. And we move on. That's part of growing up. That's part of being a professional. And so I just wonder, they're in the clubhouse all the time. And these guys are their own brands. They're their own images. They're their own reputations, everything they do. Did he have the wherewithal whatsoever? Or, as it was, I said earlier in the show, did people distance themselves from him and be like, dude, this was stupid. Why did you do this? Why do you continue to make a mountain out of a molehill? And I'm telling you, if and this is go two ways now. If he plays well and finally comes back at RBC and finishes top five, doesn't have to win it, but if he looks like he's got momentum heading next week, then he might be able to put this to bed. If it goes south, this is going to have another life when he doesn't need it. All the pressure next week gets ramped up even more. To me, if it's an equipment issue, address it, be done with it, and move on. Let sleeping dogs lie. He just will not let it go.
I think most of the people, the golf geeks, like, and I'll include myself in that. It really is not a big deal. Like, this does happen all the time. This is not some, oh, did Rory cheat at Augusta, right? But if you're new right. to the sport and you're like, well, why isn't he talking? Like, Scotty talked about it, did it with the trophy. He had the Wanamaker behind him. And he said, yeah, I had how long could I play with it? He was kidding about it. Playing with that driver at Augusta even a year ago when he won. And by the way, Scotty switched the driver and then won at the PGA Championship, right? So I don't think there's a there, but like, I don't know why you would be upset about a non-story being quote-unquote leaked that you said was going to be suppressed. Why would you suppress a non-story? That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever from a journalistic perspective. But Rory, just move on from, we all want you to. All you have to do is address it like Scotty did, and this would have already been done. We mentioned Augusta. If you want to go to Augusta National, you know, you can apply, right? I think it's open right now, the window, Jensen. To get tickets, you have to do this. It's the ultimate lottery out there. I know my friends, they go online and they try to do this. And we saw this from Pete Pappas. He said about 2 million applicants have already put in their tickets, and based on attendance figures and available tickets, your odds of winning a ticket to Augusta next year, 180-1. Jensen, would you rather play a long shot like a 17-year-old kid to win at the U.S. Open, or would you rather take your shot at 180-1, or the Browns at winning the Super Bowl at 250-1? What's a better number in your estimation?
Yeah, the realistic one is me getting the Masters ticket because the Browns aren't winning in my lifetime. And I am, again, if they surprise me, it will be the greatest, you know, sports story in our town that there ever will be, because it's one of those fleeting dreams every year. I can't believe it's that high. I can't believe it's that low. I thought it would be higher, Dave. I thought it'd be like 1 in 300, 1 in 350. I thought it would be much higher than 1 in 180.
So you think there's a better shot of getting to a free ticket to Augusta National than the Browns winning the Super Bowl this year?
Yep. Yeah. And Shador is not the answer. Sorry.
Maybe it's Dylan Gabriel. Who knows? $9.99. We do know this. If you want to become a VSiN Pro subscriber, you go to VSiN.com/subscribe. For as little as $9.99 for that very first month, those betting splits that we access all the time, you can do the same thing. So you're going to get those numbers here from Circa, from DraftKings out there, two of the more respected people out there doing this with the betting splits. So you get the best information before you make those wagers at Circa and or DraftKings. All you have to do is go to VSiN.com/subscribe, $9.99. for your very first month. Our best bets are up next.
You're tuned in to VSiN by the Books right here on VSiN.
We continue VSiN by the Books here on this Thursday edition. Dave Ross and Jensen Lewis here with you. Going to catch up with Reed Kuhn in the very next segment, talking all things UFC 316. Fascinating co-main and main event, and really up and down the card. You get to a pay-per-view of this magnitude, you can find some really intriguing betting angles. And a great conversation, and I appreciate, Jensen, when we have you on every day, obviously, from a player's perspective. And we were texting with Kelly Bidwin coming up next year with Gil Alexander on a numbers game after us here. And that really, Kelly and I, for people like Kelly and I that were quote-unquote sports journalists, reporters, whatever you want to say, we wouldn't have had jobs really in the business if athletes didn't talk to us. And we ran that soundbite in hour number one here, and it is fascinating. It wasn't a threat from Rory of like, I don't have to talk to you guys, but he did say, I don't have to talk to you guys, I can just go into my phone. And with the new age of social media, and circumvent you, the reporter. Did you find that interesting, that like, that is different from when you and I as a journalist or reporter, and you as an athlete, we didn't have that possibility, right? Pre-Twitter, if you will. But with that advent now, does that change the focus of athletes? Are like, dude, I don't need to go talk to these guys, I can just go to my phone.
So there are, in the bigger personalities, the bigger stars absolutely could circumvent it because they already have the following. But Rory needs to remember that how you got there, no one knew about you at one point. and how did you get there? It's because you had reporters and media coverage and people watching you at amateurs. And then also when you, you know, won your first major, and then, you know, there's a reason why you grew into it. Yes, the athlete must accomplish what you do in the arena, but the way that the story gets told, and we do this a lot on the college side, and it's just fascinating. I'll just use a real life example. You know, Oklahoma State and their program, Dave, they had wildfires at the middle of their season. They had four players who lost their home. It burned to the ground. Everything they owned, all they had was on their back and in their car. And they had to go through day to day just going to buy T-shirts and sneakers and, you know, finding, you know, where they were going to have food and where they were going to live. And like, those are narratives that it really gets to you, and you want to buy in even more to their story of resiliency and overcoming what was such a horrific tragedy. I mean, baseball was a fleeting thought at that point. It was more about survival and trying to survive day to day. So take it back to the modern era here. And in team sports, you and I have been around long enough to know. Yeah, you have teams that don't have studs. And how does that team get recognition? Hello, the people that cover you and tell your story and get the word out. Because you don't have enough time in the day, Dave, to go do your training and then hop on social media and do all your, I'm going to answer all these, you know, people and do that. Like, Rory, I get it. You may not have to answer questions, but you're going to have to. Look, go ahead and take it over. You may be able to hire someone for a PR firm to handle that. Like, sure. You're not running it. Just imagine the amount of time. Like, I don't think some guys think this through, that our job is way more important for them to not only sustain the brand, but to grow it from an individual standpoint and also a team standpoint as well.
Just say, he hasn't played great golf since winning at Augusta right now, one over par. He is playing the back nine right now, two holes to go there. In the betting market, he has drifted to 9-1. Remember, about plus 450 here, so he's doubled that price point here. If you want to get in on Rory, again, we're just charting it early, one over par right now. The leader is Alex Smalley. He is the rabbit right now, running out 4 under par through his first six holes. So right now, Rory is 5 off the lead. And low Canadian, at least in the odds market, is still Corey Connors at 18-1. Nick Taylor is off to a really good start. He is 20-1 right now in the live betting market. And remember, Nick won this event. That's why when you see the Canadian Open logo, the I in Canadian is Nick Taylor, after he beat Tommy Fleetwood a couple years ago with that 73-footer to win the Canadian Open. Let's get to our best bets. They are presented by GBank, the official bank of VSiN. And let's get to some Major League Baseball here. And you do have some plays that are already in pocket. Again, hopefully if you missed the Daily Diamond, we'll give you some of those. And one is the Athletics. You're not betting on the Athletics here because they are now, what, 1-20 in their last 21 games here. But maybe they can help out and get some runs scored today.
Yeah, I do think some of the numbers line up there, and depending on what book you're at, I think there's still some flat 10s there at Circa if you can jump on it. I did get 10.5 over here at DraftKings and at FanDuel. So I do think we finally go back to the well here, Dave, with our overs in Sacramento. The Athletics have been putrid as far as their bullpen, well-documented here on our show. I think the Twins offensively can continue it. By the way, you want to talk about a horrible beat yesterday? Mm. This is our Zebby Matthews over 15.5. Dude's cruising. What was he? Low to mid 70s in pitch count, and Rocco pulls him.
77 pitches.
One more. You're telling me he can't at least start the sixth? I don't understand that whatsoever. However, if you did tail us on the lotto for our pitchers yesterday, yeah, the six or more strikeouts for Boyd, for Gore, for Abbott, congratulations, your winner. Nice little plus 539 payout there. Cardinals run line. In game one, this was going to be a play for me for VSiN Pro subscribers yesterday, Dave. We go right back to the well, same pitching matchup that will be in the day game of the day-night doubleheader today. This one shortly after 1:30. Oh, no, this one, shortly after 1:45 Eastern, I believe, is game one. So that one you see on your screen is the nightcap for tonight. But I do believe the Cardinals able to put this thing together with Miles Michaelis on there. They have won 6 of his last 7 starts. And of 6 of those wins, they have won by 2 or more in 4 of the 6. So I think the offense comes to play against Noah Cameron in game 1. Remember, game 1, the run line for the Cardinals of that day-night doubleheader.
And again, we're going to have game one of the NBA Finals begins tonight. I know that Matt Brown and Kelly Bidwin are going to be all over that coming up here in the next show on A Numbers Game after us here today. We've talked a lot about it. And I'm not saying that the books hurt us, Jensen, but we have seen a slight downtick in that total. It's down to 230. Remember, it was about 230 and a half here. So as the show has gone on, and you and I kind of theorized that potentially we might get one of those slower starts. I don't know if it's so much a feeling out process, but it's more that mixing and matching of the lineups here, because we know how deep Indiana can go. So down to 230, but the side is still up to 9.5 here for Indiana and OKC. Any plays officially for you yet? Because for me, I'm leaning towards that under. You can still find 230.5 out there at Circa, and I'd certainly take a bite of that apple on the under of 230.5.
Yeah, nothing official, but I do love your play or your idea there on the under, just kind of seeing where some of that data has gone. Ticked up from 9 to 9.5. I think I leaned the Thunder at that number yesterday, so some money coming in on OKC overnight and into this morning. I'll probably wait a little bit later in case I do jump in there. But again, as I mentioned, some of the player props, I think you look in the assist market too. Siakam, as I said, you can get over 2.5 assists. Cheapest price right now at Caesar's, $1.60 is the price for 3 or more assists. Shea Gildas-Alexander, 7 or more assists. Dave, also at Caesar's, minus $1.20 for 7 or more there. And those are the ones that really kind of stick out to me from a player prop standpoint. But again, I think I'm going to be a fan more importantly. I can't wait to see the atmosphere, how Indiana's pace is counteracted by OKC's really stringent defense. So a lot of themes, a lot of narratives. But again, if you're a Pacers backer, potentially that first half, first quarter, but also if we do think the jitters are there, the total under for that first quarter as well.
By the way, Mark Melusa is going to be on with me tomorrow. You will join the program as well there from North Carolina before your duties take over for the Super Regional there. But because I won't have full time with you tomorrow, does your opinion change at all after game one of the Stanley Cup Finals? Game two numbers tomorrow night in Edmonton right now, minus $1.30 on the Oilers. Puck line, by the way, is plus $1.90 if you like Edmonton. Come back in Florida is plus $1.10. Remember, Edmonton is now over a $2 betting favorite to win this series. What do you make of that? It feels like a short price if you like Edmonton to win this, to win the whole cup here at $1.24 tomorrow in game two.
Yeah, and again, I'm with Aaron Halterman. Fabulous job with this earlier this hour, just talking about how hard of a champion, right? And where you get out to the early lead. Again, never ever want to blow a multi-goal lead on the road in the Stanley Cup final. But I think we get a pretty good idea of where Florida wants to attack Stuart Skinner. If they can get that early lead again, then I think they're going to make those necessary adjustments to get this thing level. I'm with you. No official play, but I would lean that Florida ends up getting this back to 1-1 when we go to game three in Sunrise.
And that total sitting at 6.5. Of course, the over did cash last night. It is juicy the under, though, by the way, here early, minus $1.25 for game number two. We got a $500 trifecta from GBank, First Bet, and VEASAN. All you got to do is open up a GBank Visa signature credit card in the first 90 days, deposit, and play through $1,000 at First Bet to trigger the $500 trifecta. Then you're going to get $200 in cashback rewards on your GBank Visa signature credit card. First Bet is going to give you a $100 deposit match. VEASAN will complete the trifecta with a free VEASAN Pro subscription through October 31st. That, in and of itself, is a $200 value. So that is the $500 trifecta from GBank, First Bet, and VEASAN. Head over to VEASAN.com/GBank. That's VSIN.com/GBank. This is a one-time promotion limited to customers opening up a new account in response to this offer. It will not apply to requests to convert existing accounts. Apply today. Terms and conditions do apply. We've got Reed Kuhn coming up next, talking all things UFC 316. Come on back. It's VEASAN by the Books.
The Books, right here on VEASAN.
We are back, VEASAN, by the Books. Dave Ross and Jensen Lewis cannot wait for UFC 316 Saturday night in Newark, New Jersey. You got two title fights on hand. Of course, the big rematch here, Merab Dzhulashvili against the Sugar Show, Sean O'Malley. Jensen here to help break it down. The one and only Reed Kuhn, give him a follow on X at Fightnomics, joins us here in the Progressive Guest Line, the author of a book of the same name, Fightnomics. And Reed, before we get to this card, can you tell the people where you were the day that JDM beat Bilal Muhammad last month here to become the new champion? Where were you and what was that experience like?
Yeah, it's, I feel for those Australian fans because all main cards for pay-per-views occur Sunday morning or at least Sunday around lunchtime. So I flew in overnight. I arrived in Melbourne, Australia on Sunday morning of Mother's Day and went straight to the pub. I was the only guy there at 10:30 in the morning during the prelims. But sure enough, it filled up over the course of the day. And there were a lot of people there out there supporting their guy against Bilal. He got it done. I was pulling for it. Just I wanted to see the reaction. But I think I was also pulling for it. I didn't have a big bet on it, but I was leaning towards Steve to get it done.
Yeah, it was an amazing night. I know there was some consternation. I felt like JDM clearly wanted to be in Australia for Jack to become the new champion. Pretty darn cool there. Look, Merab is, we get it. It's going to feel like almost a home match for Merab, ironically, in Jersey with the people that he trains with and the people that he associates with against the Sugar Show here Saturday night in the Bantamweight title. And if and I'm sure you have, Reed, you've heard all these subtle changes potentially for Sean. I won't go into all of them, but let's just say no marijuana. He's not gonna dye his hair like he normally does. Normally rematches don't go differently. Is this going to be a different Sean O'Malley against the Machine Saturday night?
It's a lot to ask, honestly, because you know last time I was deep on Merab, and it was the wrestling. Obviously, he uses the clinch very well to set up those takedowns. He uses multiple attempts sometimes to get you down, but once you're down, he stays very busy, so he's allowed to extend that top control time. And on the feet, we didn't really see him with vulnerabilities that you might expect against a much rangier opponent. And so with Sean O'Malley, he's still the younger guy. He's still the rangier guy, and he is still clearly the more dangerous striker. His statistics, which I will post on Twitter, are very, very good. He's a very accurate long-range striker, and that's a problem. But Merab is just so good at stuffing the distance. He gets very close. He gets you against the fence. He drags you down. And then he's going to just outwork you. And the guy's got a gas tank for days. And so I think the threat, obviously, is in those first early rounds of getting countered on the way in. But the story is still the same here. The numbers haven't really changed. In fact, arguably, they've gotten better because Merab has also proved himself against another competent grappler in Nurmagomedov. So I'm still deep on Merab. Nothing has changed for me. Maybe O'Malley is going to be a little bit more desperate having lost the first one. And that does worry me a little bit. But if anything, the price is actually getting better lately.
Yeah, Reed, and one follow-up on that, because, you know, with the wrestling advantage, you could see Merab, and obviously that really sticks out to it. If there is a way for Sean O'Malley to, if someone wants to take a speculative ad on the money line or perhaps a method of victory, how does this go O'Malley's way if Merab is just not on his game on Saturday night?
It's probably a finish. It's got to be a striking finish because you're not going to outwork him for five rounds and you're not going to submit him. O'Malley has to land that punch, and he does have the ingredients for that. And maybe you hope that there's that sneaky injury with Merab, you know, broken toe. Maybe that slows him down a little bit. Maybe that distracts him a little bit, or maybe he aggravates it during the fight. That could be a wild card TKO by injury. We saw a fight with John Jones and Chael Sonnen, where had that fight gone any longer, they might have stopped the fight because John Jones' toe was snapped in half. Mm-hmm. So that could be a wild card, but really it's O'Malley by TKO is the only pathway for him.
Yeah, and he is a wild card, Merab. We know that. Sometimes he doesn't, self-preservation is not necessarily in his DNA before we get to Saturday night. So that's for the Bantamweight Championship for the men. Obviously, the Bantamweight Championship is going to be on the line here for Juliana Pena, the Venezuelan Vixen, against Kayla Harrison. And I know that Juliana is going to feel like she's being disrespected again, as she has been in the past when she beat Amanda Nunes and lost that belt back to Amanda. So it always feels like Juliana, even though she's won this thing a couple times, is always fighting for respect. There is no respect in the marketplace, Reed. Kayla Harrison is -750 against Juliana. Is there any chance that we can see another massive upset like we saw years ago when Pena did the unthinkable and submitted Amanda Nunes?
That upset was unbelievable, statistically improbable. I did not predict that. But what we did see was Amanda Nunes fight very sloppy and get a little bit rocked early on. And Pena, to her credit, took advantage of that. She hit her hard and she took advantage and got a submission. But the ingredients just aren't here yet. I look at the numbers. Pena has relied on wrestling in the past. She's not going to have that advantage in this fight. Defensively, she has a glaring liability with only 23% takedown defense. That is not good. That is a massive liability against Kayla Harrison, who is going to be attempting takedowns at twice the average UFC rate. And then once she's in control, she does not give it up. So I just don't see the dynamics here. And Pena has been dropped four times in her career. Now, most of those, I think, were against Nunes. But while being an accurate striker, she doesn't score knockouts. She doesn't score knockdowns. And so if Harrison is at risk on the feet because of not being as evolved a striker as Pena, you just don't see the finish there. And so eventually she's going to get it down. It's kind of the same story with Merab and O'Malley. This is only going to go one way. It's going to be Harrison on top for long periods of time. The question is whether or not there's a finish. That's not something I'm going to predict. I do expect Harrison to be basically easy parlay fodder for a lot of people.
Reed, I love the idea there, and definitely different ways to attack that. Okay, other ways to attack this main card. Any particulars, any specific matchups that stand out to you, some actionable spots for people out there?
Yeah, overall, you know, this feels like a chalky card for me. I do like Sergey Spivak. That's probably the closest matchup for me, probably also the closest odds. He's not a huge favorite, and that's because Cortez Acosta is going to be much more dangerous with the hands. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the striker versus grappler dynamic, this is the riskiest one I see. Spivak has to go up against a heavyweight with very good hands, and Spivak has not been good on the feet. That's his big liability, is if he doesn't get the early takedown, he gets knocked out. But if he can get through that first round, grind you out, wear you down, then I see him kind of coasting to a decision via grappling. He definitely has the advantage with the wrestling, and he's going to go for it early. With Kevin Holland, that's another really interesting matchup with Vicente Luque. Vicente Luque is very dangerous. We're talking 16 combined knockdowns between both these fighters. But the more damaged guy, unfortunately, is Luque. He's taken four knockdowns of his own. He's on pace, actually, to cross the 1,000 mark in this fight. If he takes something like 50 total head strikes throughout the entire fight, he'll cross over 1,000 cumulative head strikes taken in the UFC. That's not a good stat either. That's something I track, is just general wear and tear of two fighters. So Kevin Holland is definitely the fresher of the two. And he's also going to look like he's in a different weight class. He's going to be massive compared to Luque, who's a little more compact for his division. Holland is just going to be so rangy. So I'm hoping that Holland can stay out of danger. Both these guys have submissions. Both these guys have knockdowns. But I think Holland is also the more efficient striker. He's going to be landing more often than he eats it. And I don't think Luque wants to play that game for too long and eat those punches. So that's a couple other favorites that I do see as relatively safe bets for me. Again, it's a chalky card. So when you're betting on all favorites, you might be looking to combine a few guys.
I got about a minute to go here, Reed. I'm glad you brought up that Luque fight against Kevin Big Mouth Holland. Luque says he still has a path to a championship. Holland's like, I just want to fight six times a year. I mean, different mentalities of those guys. We talk about it, you and I, all the time through the years, about data on new fighters into the UFC. Apache Mix is definitely a guy that everybody's talking about this week against Mario Bautista. He is blown up a little bit to a $1.85 betting favorite. How do you, with those numbers, try to incorporate what you've seen in other leagues, and now you kind of go to the big boy ranks of the UFC? Do those become stay away spots for you?
Yeah, I can't run a model on a guy I don't have data on. However, I have half data on this matchup. And so just looking at Mario Bautista, what makes him tick, I'm able to get some hints as to his game. He's very good. Yep. Listen, this guy has decent striking. He also has a ground game. He puts on a very high pace. And so if you're just thinking about those octagon jitters getting into the big stage, Patchy Mix, is he going to be able to keep up with someone like Bautista, who's been in the cage? He's a veteran. He has over 100 minutes of octagon time. You know, if I had to take a stab at a dog, it might be Bautista here. Ooh. Just because he is more proven in the octagon. I don't know if Patchy Mix can really do what he's done outside of the UFC now that he's inside of it facing UFC level talent. So if I'm looking to fade anyone, it could be that play. But again, it's not data driven on both sides. It's just me looking at one side and saying, hey, this UFC fighter is very strong. Why are we discounting him simply because we've got a champion from another promotion?
Reed, great stuff as always. Can't wait to see what's on the menu as well. Thanks for watching VSiN by the Books. Jensen, we'll see you tomorrow on Numbers Game. Matt Brown, Kelly Bidwin, they're up next.